He doubted that, but he was listening. "You have something you want to auction," Reinhardt said. "Do it. Keep whatever you derive from the sale. Then auction off what I have, and I keep whatever is derived from that. A two-in-one event, so to speak. I just want the opportunity for your buyers to bid on what I have. I conduct both sales. Absolutely. No need to interject any element of confusion. I'm sure you've invited ready, willing, and able buyers. Or governments, I assume. Now you have an additional item to sell. Lucky for us, these buyers have unlimited resources." As much as he hated to admit it, the proposal sounded reasonable, but he still wanted to know. "What is it you have?" "Let's be candid, Jonty. I could ruin your entire sale. The whole thing depends on secrecy. I wonder, were the Poles invited? I wouldn't think so. I would not have if I were in your shoes. So I wonder what a call to Warsaw would accomplish." He kept his face stoic, but the threat worked. "Okay, Eli, I understand. You can wreck the whole thing, and that potential gives your presence here value. So I'm listening. And if you are thinking about secreting me away with Art Munoz, know that if I don't call in every 3 hours, contact will be made to Warsaw by some associates I've employed." He doubted that was a bluff, a wise precaution, one he himself would have taken if the roles were reversed. "Okay, we have a deal. What's your gift?" Reinhardt smiled at his success. "Towards the end of Soviet domination, around 1991 is the best guess, the Sluzhba Bezpieczeństwa hid away a huge cache of documents. By then the SB had amassed thousands of informants, many of whom had risen to high positions within Solidarity and the emerging political parties of the time. Some of them volunteered to be spies. Others did it for money. Others were coerced or blackmailed. Many had no idea they'd been classified as informants. Their information came to SB headquarters via a friend, colleague, or family member who'd turned collaborator and sold them out. As insurance, perhaps something to be used in the future, the SB hid away documents relative to those informants. The place where they are stored is called the Spiżarnia." His mind raced. He knew that Poland had for years dealt with the lingering pain of both Nazi and communist rule. The Institute of National Remembrance and the Commission for the Prosecution of Crimes Against the Polish Nation had been around for decades, amassing a huge archive of information that had been used in prosecutions. Most of that happened in the 1990s, in the years right after the Soviet collapse. Never, though, had any great stash of Soviet-era documents been discovered. Most of the revelations trickled in from old government warehouses, offices, and private stashes. He'd managed to stumble onto a stack of 147 pages that dealt with a young Solidarity activist named Janusz Czerkowski. A former SB major had kept a trove of documents from his time in government. That man was long dead, but his son had recently tried to find a buyer. A friend, whom Jonty had done business with before, learned of the effort, and 500,000 zlotys had completed the sale. He'd originally planned to hold on to the information and explore ways to maximize its value. Then the United States announced a renewed effort to locate missiles in Poland. Perfect. Exactly what he'd needed. The barely meaningful became vitally important. Now, this. A partner. Something new to the mix. "What does the pantry contain?" he asked. "My German friends speculate that the documents detail thousands of names of people who acted as Soviet informants. Probably reports, correspondence, affidavits, all sorts of information stored away for safekeeping." "Has someone seen this cache?" Eli shook his head. "The Germans never went after it, and it was largely forgotten until they received your invitation. Fortunately for me, I was in the midst of another deal with them. something of much greater importance from their standpoint. So we modified the terms to include their invitation to your auction and this lost cash, both of which are now mine. 1,000 questions raced through his brain, but one overcame all the others. That was quite generous of them. I assure you, what I provided to them was worth far more. That was saying a lot, maybe even too much. Are you sure this cash is real? Reinhardt sat back in his chair. That's the thing, Eli. I'm not. My friends in Berlin were clear. None of this has been verified. You made a deal on something that might not even exist. Reinhardt smiled. Your auction is real. I reasoned that, at a minimum, I could extract a payment from you not to interfere with that. He was cornered and did not like it. We need to find out if the pantry is real, Reinhardt said. What do you propose? That we have a look. He hated that word, we. This was his sale, his venture. But his choices seemed limited. Reinhardt could surely disrupt things. And why not? He had zero to lose. So he did what he did best and made a bargain. I want a cut of whatever you receive on your portion of the deal. Reinhardt grinned. How much? 20%. That's quite a cut. I have expenses on the auction that you would need to contribute toward. A lot of money has been spent on privacy and security, which raises a point. How did you find me? Once the Germans showed me your invitation, I sent men out to track you down. I know your haunts, as you probably know mine. When Munoz disappeared, I assumed I'd found you. And how did you know how to call me? Reinhardt smiled. It wasn't all that hard. Like you, I have friends with capabilities. You left a contact number with the agency that handles Sterne Castle. It's the only fortress like it, available for rent in Slovakia. Lots of privacy. He cursed himself for being so careless. If he'd made that big a mistake with Eli, what others had he made? Were some of the potential buyers closing in? Had the auction site been compromised? Thank goodness last night he'd taken those final precautions. Then a frightening thought occurred to him. You followed me last night, didn't you? Eli nodded again. And when you drove north to Krakow, then to Wieliczka. My heart leaped. He waited. The pantry is hidden away inside that salt mine. Chapter 26 Cotton kept his mouth shut and his temper in check until he and Bunch were in a car alone, driving away from the monastery, Bunch behind the wheel. That should buy you some time, Bunch finally said. The president himself told Tchaikovsky that we were backing off, that there'd be no American presence at the auction. Him hearing that directly should do the trick. So Fox flat out lied to a head of state. Bunch waved off the accusation. He merely misdirected him. I simply reinforced that misdirection. He shook his head. Both of you are idiots. That's the president of the United States you're talking about. Yeah, that's the scary part. They were on a two-laned highway paralleling the river Wisła, headed back toward Kraków. You should have a clear path to the spear now, Bunch said. Tom, can I call you Tom? He didn't wait for a reply. I make it a point not to say things I might regret later, especially to people who work for the White House. But with you, I'll make an exception. How about you go Bunch pointed at his cell phone. Odd. It rested in the center console between their seats. He'd already noticed it, but had not paid much attention. He lifted the unit and saw that it was on a live call, the setting to speaker. Mr. President, Bunch said, Malone knows you're listening. He shook his head. This was beyond belief. It's good to know what you really think of me, Fox said. I didn't know that was a secret, given our first encounter. You apparently didn't learn a thing from almost being blown up. I actually did. I learned that I want my own people handling things. No more of Danny Daniels' leftovers. Your people are incompetent. As am I. He had zero intention of backing down. You're at the head of the line. Bunch's face carried a smug grin, clearly pleased with the disrespect being shown. Ordinarily, Cotton, I can call you that, right? Fox said through the phone. I'd just tell Tom to fire you, hang up, and move on. We can hire other people. But you're there on the ground, ready to go, and time is really short. We only have until midnight to steal that spear. The only reason I might is so I can shove it, Cotton, Fox said, interrupting. Just steal the spear. Then I want you and Tom to go to the auction and buy whatever information Jaunty Olivier is selling. These two were bold SOBs. He'd give them that. I was elected president, Fox said, because I had the balls to go out and ask people to vote for me. I think big. The problem with most people is they don't think big. They're afraid to think big. So they latch on to people, like me, who think big. I'm not scared to win. I like to win. I do what I have to do in order to win. I don't really give a crap, Cotton said to the phone. I don't have a dog in this fight. Except for the $150,000 Stephanie Nell promised you. I can live without it. Fox chuckled. I'm sure you can. But I want those missiles in Poland, and if you don't help me out, I'm going to do what I told President Tchaikovsky I would do. I'll fire Stephanie Nell, and the Magellan Billet will be disbanded. All of the American intelligence divisions will be told not to hire her. She will be persona non grata. If anyone in the private sector wants to hire her, she won't receive any positive references from this administration. Quite the contrary, in fact. Her career choices will be limited to going to work for one of my enemies. He hated bullies, and that's exactly what he was dealing with. And the best way to handle bullies was to get right in their face, because at their core, they were cowards. Right now, though, he had little to nothing to bargain with. But if he had the spear. They were beginning to enter Kraków's outer suburbs, coming in from the west, and ahead across the river he spotted Wawel Castle. Its tawny defensive walls rose nearly 100 feet above the water, at once massive and slender, tapped by domes and towers. The seat of Polish kings for more than a millennium, though now only their tombs remained. It was both a museum storing precious objects and a work of art itself, the symbol of Poland, and where the spear of St. Maurice waited, his best bargaining chip. Did you hear me, Malone? President Fox said. You really are a prick. Like I care what you think. If I wanted a conscience, I'd buy one. What I want is those missiles in Poland. More important, I want Russia to know that the days of rolling over the United States are through. I think Danny Daniels might disagree with your assessment of his 8 years in office. I'm sure he would, but I'm going to do what it takes to get the job done. When you mess with Stephanie, you'll be messing with Daniels. I doubt the junior senator from Tennessee could do much to harm me. No sense arguing with a fool who clearly underestimated his opponents. Just steal the spear, Malone, and win that auction. And if I do, what happens to Stephanie? Not a thing. You do know that you're not the most trustworthy person. I'm all you have. Take it or leave it. Normally, he'd leave it. But two factors urged otherwise. One, he did not want Stephanie to experience the misery Fox would enjoy heaping on her. And two, Janusz Tchaikovsky was not the fool he wanted people to think he was. The U.S. announces a missile initiative, then, because Poland simply doesn't want it, they reverse course. That might happen, as it did years ago, when a bunch of time had passed so everyone could save face, but not this quick. Not by a long shot. Tchaikovsky was up to something, too, in playing along, and he suspected what that might be. But neither the moron driving the car nor the one on the phone had a clue, which almost made him smile. Do you have any assistance from American intelligence on this operation? He asked Fox. Only the great Stephanie Nell and her wonderful Magellan Billet. Besides that, that's all. This is a White House-based initiative. Everything held close. As he suspected. Which clinched the deal. I'll get the spear, he said. He was driven back near the cloth market, Bunch leaving and providing a cell phone number for contact. He walked to where his own vehicle was parked and called Stephanie, reporting all that had happened. I should resign, she said. I can't work for these people. I hate that I'm even about to say this, since it's not my problem. But if we walk away, America could be in real trouble. The Russians are heavy into this, along with the Poles, and they're not fooling around. This could take a bad bounce. I agree. I've had an awful feeling from the start. I can't tell you how relieved I was when they told me you were in Bruges. That was about as close to warm and fuzzy as she would ever get, and he appreciated the sentiment. I'll get the spear, he said. Then we'll decide what's next for both you and the country. I'm in Warsaw, at the embassy, but I'm headed south for the consulate in Krakow. I'll be there in a few hours. He'd assumed she hadn't left, or had even been ordered away. I'm going to do a little recon, then handle things tonight. The info you've already provided was helpful. You think the Poles will be waiting for you? He'd told her his hunch. There's no doubt in my mind. Then why go? Because they need me to do it, too. Chapter 27 Jaunty arrived back at the castle, still shaken by the meeting. He could not decide if Reinhardt was being truthful or merely posturing, trying to edge his way into a deal that he had no part in making. Prior to obtaining the evidence on Janusz Czachowski, he'd done some extensive research, all designed to ascertain if what he'd been offered was real. That was where he'd come across what happened to Lech Wałęsa. An electrician in the Gdansk shipyard, working long hours for little pay like everyone else, Wałęsa became a trade union advocate and one of the co-founders of Solidarity. Images of his mustachioed face, being borne aloft by workers, became an inspiration for anti-communist movements across the Soviet bloc. He was arrested many times and imprisoned, but eventually led the charge to end communist rule, winning the Nobel Peace Prize. But he did not travel to Stockholm to get it, fearing he would not be allowed back in the country. He was the first to be elected to the renewed position of President of Poland. But his popularity waned, and he was defeated for re-election in 1995 after only one term. Charges of collaboration had long dogged Wałęsa. 279 pages of documents eventually surfaced, all from the widow of a former communist interior minister who'd tried to sell them. The similarities with what was happening here with Czachowski were frightening. The difference being that Wałęsa's dirt went public. The Institute of National Remembrance studied it in detail, hiring experts who concluded that the documents were authentic. The story they told was of a Wałęsa who led protests and strikes that shook communist rule in the 1980s, but had also apparently been a paid informant for the secret police in the 1970s. Wałęsa claimed fraud, saying they were created by the government to discredit him. A valid charge, considering the parties involved, and a court exonerated him. Questions remained, though. The issue of collaboration recurred when the Conservative Law and Justice Party, run by a former anti-communist activist, an enemy of Wałęsa's, assumed power. Eventually, Wałęsa admitted signing a commitment to inform for the SB, but denied ever fulfilling it. There were at least 30 reports bearing the signature of Bolek, the codename assigned to Wałęsa, all deemed authentic. In addition, there were cash receipts for payments to him that also bore his verified signature. Quite the PR disaster for a legend. One Wałęsa never really recovered from. Enough, Jaunty had hoped, to scare Czachowski into not tempting fate, making him willing to do whatever the holder of the information on him might want. He entered the castle and told Vic, "Let the man in the basement go." He'd already explained on the drive back what had happened inside the restaurant. We need to go back to the mine, Eli included. Can you arrange it? Vic nodded. Please do it fast. I want this matter resolved in the next few hours. He'd made a deal with Reinhardt on the condition that the cash still existed and was marketable. If so, there'd be a joint auction. If not, he'd agreed to pay 20 million euros for his competition to stay out of the way. The Yarmouk Christi should bring that amount. The rest from the auction would be all his. He had not liked making the deal, but there was plenty of money to go around, so he decided to spend what it took to keep Reinhardt at bay. Of course, if the cash was there and relevant, many more millions could be made by them both. So what did he have to lose by taking a look? Tchaikovsky sat inside the Royal Vavel suite at the Sheraton Grand Krakow. The hotel, a modern precast concrete and steel structure, faced the River Wisła, within the shadow of Vavel Castle, displayed in all its glory beyond the room's east windows. He'd decided to stay over for the night to be close to what was about to happen, the move camouflaged by a meeting arranged with local officials, many of whom had been clamoring for a moment of his time. He'd managed to contain his anger with both President Fox and Tom Bunch. Both were treating him like a fool, and Poland like a second-rate nation. Which was nothing new. Kings, queens, emperors, and premiers had been doing the same thing for centuries. But not this time. Sonia would make sure that would not happen. How lucky he was to have her. But he had to be careful. Poland remained a deeply Catholic country. While divorce was legal, the church frowned on it. Separations, though, were tolerated. But neither would be acceptable for the president of the country, and open adultery would be politically fatal. What was the only legal grounds for divorce? The irretrievable and complete disintegration of matrimonial life, along with a lack of any spiritual, physical, or economic bonds, which all applied to his marriage. Thankfully, there were no children involved. His wife had steadfastly refused to have any, making that clear from the start. So he could not complain. But he'd be as big a liar as the Americans if he said that he did not regret that decision. Instead, the nation had become his child. He'd dedicated himself to Poland. Nearly 40 million people depended on him making the right decisions, and he was not going to let them down. His cell phone rang, and he was glad to see it was Sonia. "Where are you?" he asked her. "Making preparations." Back at the monastery, she'd explained her plan and how she intended to deal with Cotton Malone. He'd sensed there was a history between them, and for a moment, he had been jealous. He'd not felt that emotion in a long time. It had actually felt good. Made him alive once again. He realized he had no right to be jealous about anything that had happened prior to their relationship. It was none of his business. But it still bothered him. He loved Sonia, and he firmly believed she felt the same. She was doing everything she could to help him, and he appreciated that more than she would ever know. Or maybe she might. "Thank you for doing this," he felt compelled to say. "My pleasure, Mr. President." He loved it when she called him that. "I'll expect a more proper thank you, though. In person," she noted. He chuckled. "And I'll be more than happy to supply that. First, I have to deal with an old adversary. He's good, really good. So this has to be done with precision. We only have one chance." "I agree. And I intend to make it count." Chapter 28 Cotton glanced up at Vavel Castle. He stood on a busy sidewalk, facing the fortress's east wing, the golden stone walls rising nearly 100 feet to a steeply pitched roof. The exterior seemed a carefully choreographed collection of galleries, piers, columns, and balconies. Many called it the Polish Acropolis, towering over Kraków, once the seat of secular and ecclesiastical power. On the upper floor, he spotted a columned loggia that, according to the information he'd been provided, led to where the spear of St. Maurice was currently being stored. Ordinarily, the spear was kept on permanent display within the John Paul II Cathedral Museum, located just inside the castle's main gates. The museum housed one of the most valuable collections of art and artifacts in Poland. Hundreds of thousands of people visited every year, so many that the building had been closed for the past few months, undergoing an extensive renovation, its treasures stored away for safekeeping in several different locations. The spear had been moved inside the castle, currently locked away with a few other valuables in an upper floor room, the windows of which he was now studying from ground level. The time was approaching 5 p.m. Whoever had performed the recon for Stephanie had learned a wealth of excellent information. The castle itself was open for another 20 minutes. What was once the bakery and infirmary, a building fronting the inner courtyard, had long ago been converted into administrative offices. An interior door from that building led into the castle, for staff use only. It was locked, but not impenetrable. Guards patrolled all of the floors at intervals, and there were cameras, but not that many. The recon report advised that they were avoidable if one was careful. A photocopy of the second floor layout had also been provided. It appeared to have come from a book on the castle. The entrance from the administrative offices circled along with the room where the spear was stored, near what was known as the loggia atop the Danish tower. To get from one to the other meant navigating a dozen rooms along the north wing before turning into the east side of the building. That made for lots of opportunities to be discovered, but the intel advised that if he stayed to the interior side walls, he could avoid all three cameras along the way. He crossed the street and made his way up Vavel Hill along a brick-enclosed passage to a massive Renaissance gate. Humanity wheezed and murmured all around, more people flowing out than in, as the site was preparing to end another day. He bypassed the exiting tourists and entered the castle grounds. The Cathedral Museum rose to his right, its entrance barred by a rope barrier and a sign noting the building was closed. The cathedral stood to his left, few people moving in and out its iron gate. He'd bought a ball cap in town, which was now firmly planted on his head and should help with anonymity. The recon report noted that there were cameras all across the exterior of the buildings. He had to assume the Poles were watching, so he needed to move fast. He angled left toward the administrative building. A manicured lawn spread out between the buildings within the inner sanctum. Towers were everywhere, offering excellent vantage points. They all had names. Labels like Sigismund, Thieves, Bell, Senators, Danish, and Hens. A large legend of the castle grounds, framed from the elements, stood off to the right. Visitors were studying the map. He took a moment and gave it a glance too, noting the local geography, keeping a watch on the double doors. A crowd walked past, and he used them for cover as he approached and slipped inside the admin building, which had not been locked for the day. Inside were offices. Whoever prepped this mission had provided a rough sketch of the corridors, showing exactly where he needed to go. Being a field agent entailed doing things that most people shied away from, like trespassing and breaking and entering. He'd grown accustomed to those violations as a means to get the job done. But they represented a path, he'd had to remind himself, that was no longer readily available now that he was retired. An inner staircase led up, which he avoided. Instead, he followed a whitewashed corridor and turned right. A carpet runner lined the stone floor, and closed doors at periodic intervals on both sides led into offices. No cameras here. Nothing to steal. This was a workplace. He followed the drawing etched into his memory and found a vestibule, where a wide stone staircase led up at right angles. At the top of the first rung of risers, a small wooden door, encased within a stone frame, led from this building into the castle. He climbed to the landing and noticed that the entryway was protected by two locks. One was a simple keyed tumbler, easy to pick. The other a piece of braided wire threaded through two holders, one on the door, the other the jamb, the ends twisted together and sealed with a clamp. A simple and effective way to know if the door had been opened. Now, the hard part. He had to disappear for a few hours. He descended the stairs back to ground level. The intel he'd reviewed offered little in the way of hiding places. He assumed there were people still in the building, though he hadn't seen anyone as yet. They would soon all be gone but for the guards. He could not just hang around in the halls. The vestibule before him was empty, save for a huge rosewood chiffarobe. He walked over and opened it. Empty. The inside plenty large enough to accommodate him. Why not? He'd hidden in worse places. He wiggled his way into the space and settled his spine against one of the side walls, his knees folded up, but not all that uncomfortable. He'd be fine for a few hours. He closed the doors. Hopefully no one would inspect inside. He found his phone and made sure it was set to silent. A text had come from Cassiopeia. Where are you? He knew she wasn't going to like the truth. In Poland, hiding inside a cabinet, waiting to steal a 1,000-year-old artifact. So he opted to not reply. Chapter 29, 7:50 p.m. Jonty was back inside the Wieliczka salt mine. Vic had arranged for another special tour, this time for three people. Eli had supplied some of what he knew, and their guide had brought along another map that, hopefully, would lead them where they needed to go.
This is an old drawing, Conrad said, from when the communists ran this place.
They stood inside the magnificent chapel of St. Kinga, 100 meters underground. 20,000 tons of salt had been removed to create it. 30 meters long, 15 wide, nearly 20 tall, its floor spanned 500 square meters of polished salt. One of the largest underground churches in the world, it was laid out in the late 19th century with loving devotion. He admired its lavish decoration and iconography. Once, when miners lived underground for weeks at a time, exchanging sunlight for lamps and candles, religion played a big part in their lives. Hymns accompanied their descent. They greeted each other with a reverent God bless. Eventually, to pass the time, some of them became artisans, carving in the salt, molding larger-than-life statues and dioramas scattered across the mine. 40 chapels were eventually created, and since the 17th century, Catholic services had been routinely held in many of them. St. Kinga's was the crown jewel. More a cathedral than chapel, decorated by 5 massive chandeliers made of elaborate salt crystals, numerous sculptures, and 3-dimensional bas-reliefs of breathtaking detail, all inspired by New Testament themes, a tribute generations of the minor sculptors left to their Christian faith. Jonty studied the map. Nazis occupied the mine during the war and tried to use it as an underground factory, employing slave labor. But the Soviet advance thwarted the effort. After the war, the communists assumed control and kept possession until 1990. Then the new Polish Republic took over and had operated it ever since.
I've worked here for a number of years, Conrad said. We've all been told stories of when the communists were in charge. We were still extracting salt then. I've heard that they also used this place as a storage facility. There's a huge chamber down on level 9. In a part of the tunnels that's off limits. But I've seen it.
Eli seemed intent on what he was hearing.
It's filled with wooden shelving, Conrad said. The iron frames are all corroded, though. The salt has eaten them away. Why they used iron, I have no idea. It doesn't last down there.
With his finger, Conrad traced a route on the map.
That chamber is here.
How far down? Eli asked.
Over 300 meters.
His competitor clearly was not pleased with that information.
You don't like closed spaces?
I don't like prisons, Eli said.
You're welcome to wait here, Jonty said. I appreciate your concern for my comfort, but I'll suffer through it and come along.
What are we after? Conrad asked.
Jonty wanted to hear the answer to that question too, as did Vic, who'd stood silent.
A chamber called Warszawa, Eli said.
A puzzled look came to Conrad's face.
There is such a chamber. It's the grand ballroom, not far from here, where banquets, parties, and conferences are held. You can't mean that.
This one would be secreted away.
I know of lower-level chambers named Modena, Weimar, Florencia, Toscania, and other locations in Europe and Poland.
but none named for Vorsa.
As before, they were each dressed in coveralls with a helmet and light, ready for a special tour. They'd descended from the Regis shaft, then walked half a kilometer over in a level 2 drift to the main tourist areas. Jaunty had wondered about the change in procedure, as they usually descended straight to level 9 in the Regis shaft elevator. "Why did we come here?" he asked, "and not go directly to level 9? Conrad pointed.
"Because this map is for level 10.
He caught the look on Vic's face. He was thinking the same thing.
"I didn't know there was anything that deep. It was opened in the 1950s, expanded in the 1960s, but closed in the mid-1970s.
He caught the significance of those dates, all during the time of communist control. Conrad nodded.
"There's no elevator to that level, only a wooden staircase that's not in good shape from level 9. No tour groups are ever taken down there. The elevator to get us closest to that staircase is not far from here."
"How accurate is this map?" Vic asked.
"I have no idea. I know of a few miners who've been there. They say the tunnels are fairly clear, but there's a lot of water seepage. No maintenance has been done there in decades."
It caught the unspoken warning. Danger existed.
"We have no options," Jaunty told Conrad. "We have to take a look." "The good part is that there are only a few tunnels, lots of offshoots, but only 3 main drifts. As you can see on the map, nothing is labeled, no names on anything. But that could be different down there."
Jaunty stared at Eli. "Are you sure about this? It seems a lot of risk for something that could be pure fiction."
"We'll never know unless we look."
He stared around at the incredible church. Its pulpit at one end imitated Vavel Hill with its fortifications and dragon. The opposite end was dominated by a salt statue of John Paul II. A sign in several languages advised that this remained a living place of worship, as Mass was still said here every Sunday. Visitors were busy admiring everything. He glanced at Vic, whose good sense and patience he'd come to rely upon. His associate had not been happy when told about the budding partnership with Eli Reinhardt. Nor had he been eager to release their prisoner, who was now waiting up at ground level in the car that had brought Reinhardt north into Poland. Their past experiences with Eli had all been competitive, but this deal was different in scope and magnitude. Hundreds of millions of euros were at stake. They were juggling the competing interests of 7 sovereign nations, most of which cared little to nothing for the others. All 7 possessed the resources to wreak havoc if they so chose. Now another element had interjected itself. If the pantry proved real, the potential could be enormous. If not, then this was a colossal waste of time and an unnecessary risk. But what the hell? He'd not become one of the world's most successful information brokers by being timid. Besides, Eli Reinhardt was coming with him, so both their asses were on the line. "You're right," he said, motioning that they should leave. "There seems to be only one way to find out if we have something."
Chapter 30 Cotton checked his watch. 8:20 p.m. He'd been inside the Schiffer robe almost 3.5 hours, catching a little bit of rest, but staying alert in case there was any movement outside. So far, he'd heard nothing. All quiet. He could wait until later in the night, or the early morning hours of tomorrow. But if his hunch proved correct, the time of his visit would not matter. His intel had noted that the castle was cleaned 3 nights a week, and this wasn't one of those nights, so there would be no janitorial staff about. Was Sonia expecting him? Probably. And if she was here, what outcome did she want? Him to take the spear? Most likely. Why else play along with Fox and Bunch? Best guess? Their alliance with the Russians was tenuous at best. Sure, neither Russia nor Poland wanted missiles, but Poland would want the information being offered destroyed, while Russia would love to have it. For the future. Just in case. He realized that the Poles could not just give the spear to him. It was a national treasure. Too many questions would be raised, ones with difficult answers. All of the other relics had been stolen, their thefts suppressed. But the fact that something had happened where they were kept had made it to the media, and all of those relics were no longer on display. The same had to happen here, with a verified incident, minus the actual theft to report. Time to get this party going. He pushed open the Schifferobe's door and climbed out. The exterior windows in the vestibule were darkened, signaling that night had begun to arrive. Only a few lights burned inside, illuminating the staircase that angled its way up to the next floors. Stephanie had thought ahead and left him two lockpicks in the manila envelope he'd pocketed earlier. For a long time, he used to carry them in his wallet, but he'd dropped the habit a while back. After all, his primary profession was now bookseller, and nothing in that job involved illegal breaking and entering. He checked the corridors one last time. Empty. Before heading up the stairs, he noticed a large 3D model of the castle grounds that filled one side of the vestibule. He took a moment and examined the exterior layout, particularly the east facade, where the intel had said the spear was being stored in a top-floor outer room. He noticed the same columned loggia he'd spotted before entering the castle and the buttresses that helped keep the wall upright. A solitary exterior window, adjacent to the loggia, had to open into the room he sought. He climbed the stone risers and approached the closed wooden door at the landing. A small metal plate read 122. He assumed, with so many doors, the only way to distinguish among them was to assign numbers. Before opening the lock, he worked the braided wire that formed a seal on the door back and forth enough that the heat snapped it. Then he picked the lock and freed the tumblers, turning the handle. He stepped inside and quickly reclosed the door. Before him stretched a dimly lit exhibit area, the space filled with glass cases displaying some fine Persian carpets, many stitched with blooming trees and fairy tale animals. Others had lions, bears, gazelles, pheasants, and unicorns. He hustled toward the open portal in the far wall and entered another room displaying battle flags, swords, and saddles, all Turkish, surely acquired during the many invasions. He turned left, following the floor plan ingrained in his memory, seeing it as if it hung before his eyes. Through three more chambers, he came to another stairway, which he bypassed, entering what was identified as the Senator's Hall, the walls decorated with figural tapestries, all with biblical themes. And the first with a camera. It hung in the corner to his right with a diagonal view of the checkerboard floor. Hard to know for sure how wide a lens it sported, but the intel recommended staying close to the south wall, the tricky part at the end, where another open doorway awaited. He hustled forward, hugging the wall, moving sideways, staying as flat as possible. 10 feet from the end, he sucked a breath and rushed through the doorway, disappearing on the other side to the left, using the wall for protection. If he was going to be spotted, this was the moment. He hesitated and listened. Footsteps were approaching from ahead, a steady click of leather heels on stone. He spotted a tall chair and sought refuge behind it, but the footsteps stopped before reaching him. A door opened, then closed. The footsteps faded. Had to be a guard making rounds. He held steady for a moment, then kept going, moving through the Eagle Room, the Bird Room, and ending up in the Battle of Orsha Room, each festooned with coats of arms, crossed swords, and dark-aged beams. An ethereal glow came from amber nightlights. Several had walls of cordovan and were decorated with period paintings, portraits, wall friezes, floral motifs, glazed ceramic stoves, sculptures, and heavy period furniture. Coffered ceilings stretched overhead with carved and gilt rosettes. In the Orsha room, he spotted the double pedimented doors in the east wall that he'd been told were there. They should be unlocked, and he quickly discovered that was true. They led to a small anteroom atop what was known as the Danish Tower. The space was lined with faux-painted walls, the coffered ceiling gilded. There were a few inlaid chairs, a desk, a chest, and a large copper mirror. Two side tables were draped with a green wool cloth. Once it had surely been a small study that opened out to the columned loggia, a perfect place for a king to relax and enjoy some fresh air. A closed door led outside. Paintings dotted the walls, more stacked upright on the floor, 5 and 6 deep. 3 heavy oak tables were covered with vases, clocks, statues, and busts. The room seemed to be doubling now as a storage chamber. He turned to the right and tried another door, one that he knew led to an even smaller space. His destination. Locked. Damn. That was not anticipated. And the lock was not one he could pick. Old style, accepting only a skeleton key. The door itself was solid and opened inward, the hinges on the other side. No way to break it down. Damn. Sonia was making him work for it. He remembered the castle model. He'd come this far. Finish it. He opened the outer door that led onto the loggia and stepped into the night. Krakow stretched below, beyond the castle wall, people moving about on the sidewalks, cars in the street. The long side of the columned terrace was open air with pillared arches, its two ends closed. The night deepened by the minute, hopefully heading toward enough darkness to shield him for a few minutes. He climbed the railing and tested the small stone ledge that extended outward. Solid. He levered himself over and held on to the short wall, adjusting his balance and peering around the loggia's short side. The window was there, just as on the model. He glanced down, maybe 75 to 80 feet to the ground. That fall would leave a mark, if not kill him. No way in hell Cassiopeia would ever be out here. She hated heights as much as he hated enclosed spaces. He pressed against the ledge, hands high, searching for fingertip grips in the stone, and turned the corner. Thankfully, the old castle was full of footholds, and he used the shallow ledge to move along, finally stopping at the window. Double-paneled, 16-paned, opening in the middle, to the inside. Not good. He pushed on the panels and felt a tiny give. He kept one arm on the sill, toes tucked into a crevice along the ledge, and pushed harder with the flat of his hand, hoping the panels might release. No luck. He spied the catch through the glass. He could not stay dangled out here much longer before someone on the street spotted him. Luckily, this side of the castle was not lit to the outside, all of the lighting confined to the picturesque north and west sides that faced the river. He balled his fist and popped one of the panes hard, quickly withdrawing his hand. It cracked, but did not break. Two more blows and it shattered. Carefully, he reached in and freed the latch, swinging the sash inward. Then he climbed in over the sill. Wooden crates filled the small space, wall to wall, each labeled in Polish and English. Gilded bowl and jug, monstrance, crozier of Adam, coronation mantle. Precious artifacts from the Cathedral Museum, stored for safekeeping, exactly as the intel stated. The fact that there were also English labels made him smile. Sonia knew he did not speak Polish. She'd thought ahead, as always. On another oak table sat several smaller wood boxes, each also labeled. Funerary objects of Bishop Morris, Saracen Sicilian case, Zucchetto and sash of John Paul II. Then, the jackpot, Spear of St. Morris. He lifted the pine box, about 2 feet long and 6 inches wide, secured with screws. No way to open it and make sure it contained what he'd come for. But it was heavy. Another good sign. That it was here, right where the intel indicated. A better sign. He cradled the box and hustled back the way he'd tried to come, through the locked door which opened from his side, and back into the larger Battle of Orsha room. An impressive frieze depicting the Polish victory over the Muscovites wrapped the room. Some tall portraits of important people dotted the walls. To the right was the route back to where he'd started. To the left was an open portal into the next room, another doorway farther down, then another, through all the rooms in succession, the doorways connected in an uninterrupted enfilade. A perfect line of sight from one end of the east wing to the other, nearly 200 feet long. About halfway down, he saw a black figure moving his way. One of the guards. In a flash of light, as the shadow moved from one room to another, he caught a face. Sonia. With a gun. Up and level. Aimed his way. Chapter 31. Jonty did not like the look of the wooden staircase leading down into blackness. Conrad had led them off the main tourist routes of level 3 to an elevator used exclusively by the miners, where they'd descended to level 9. Not the same area they'd visited last night. That was nearly a kilometer away. But the tunnels here were similar. They then wound a path through them, following Conrad into one of the offshoots where they found the old staircase.
"It doesn't appear it can handle our weight," Chanti said. "Stay to the outside on the rungs, and we should be fine. I'll go first."
Conrad began to descend, slow and deliberate, hugging the interior side where supports helped hold the load. Eli went next. Jaunty followed, with Vic assuming the rear. The wooden rungs were battered, the saw marks still evident at their ends. Many of the nail heads corroded away, causing the risers to rattle loose. The only light came from their helmets, the beams herky-jerky with their slow, cautious descent. The staircase seemed to go forever at right angles down. It took a few minutes to make it back to solid ground. Level 10 was a mess, the tunnel ahead littered with salt blocks, the walls and ceiling crystallized with dripstones, more precipitated salt icing the walls and timbers.
"I told you this was dangerous," Conrad said. "If it's any comfort, we haven't had a cave-in anywhere in decades."
That wasn't much solace. Added to the problem was the fact that no one above knew they were even here.
"Salt makes for a really good support," Conrad said as he found the map and studied it again. "This tunnel goes for about half a kilometer. There are several offshoots. We're going to have to explore them to see if there's a chamber named Warsaw."
Vic noticed something in the floor and bent down to examine it.
"A rail line."
Jaunty also saw the iron embedded into the salt floor, mostly corroded away. He'd seen them before in the upper levels, but those were in much better condition.
"They installed tracks to haul out debris," Conrad said. "It's typical for the mine."
"But it also could have been used to haul things in," Eli noted. Conrad nodded.
"That's true. This level is unique. It was not opened by miners centuries ago. It's only 50 to 60 years old."
"And not all that reinforced," Jaunty noted. Something else caught his eye. It wasn't the gray-green salt rock that dominated. This was more crystallized, clear, with hints of yellow. He bent down and lifted a small chunk, examining it in his helmet light.
"The miners call it Spock," Conrad said. "Starling, like the bird. It's fibrous salt and rare to find on the upper levels. Down here, it's common. When the miners' picks broke it, the pungent smell of sulfur leaked out. Quite a surprise to them. They thought themselves close to hell when that happened."
Jaunty examined the chunk with his fingers, the crystals sparkling in his lamp.
"Go ahead," Conrad said. "Keep it. I do, when I find some of it."
Jaunty grinned and pocketed the small rock. They crept ahead, negotiating the debris, heading deeper into the drift. The tunnel width and height were less than on level 9, but the ventilation seemed the same, and for that he was grateful. Conrad stopped the parade, his headlight focused on one of the white signs common in the levels above. This one not affixed to the wall, but propped on the floor at a junction with one of the offshoots.
Tarnów, a city in southeastern Poland. "We need to check these offshoots," Conrad said. "There's one here and another farther down. Two of us take this one, two take the next. Just keep in a straight line, don't venture off, and let's see if there's a chamber called Warsaw down either of them."
Conrad and Eli walked ahead. Jaunty and Vic turned into the offshoot marked Tarnów. The passage stretched about 20 meters, where it opened into a small chamber about 10 meters square, one side protected by wooden cribbing, leached with moisture.
"This could have once been a place for storage," he said to Vic. "Crates stacked, that sort of thing. Nothing here now."
They headed back and learned that Conrad and Eli had found nothing either. So they kept going down the drift, passing two more offshoots marked Kielce and Radom, more Polish towns.
"There seems to be nothing down here but empty chambers," he noted.
Eli waved off his pessimism.
"Which for once surely filled." "When Vic called earlier about coming here," Conrad said, "I asked around. Most of the guides working now came long after the Soviet downfall. Some of the retired workers might know about this level. I've heard stories that things were stored deep back in the 1960s and 1970s.
Jonty was concerned about those inquiries. Bad enough they had to involve Conrad. They certainly could not afford any more nosy eyes and ears. The good part was that they were in the home stretch.
From now on, he said, let's keep this between us. Of course, I understand. Vic made all that clear. You don't have to worry about me.
I was careful with my questions.
They kept following the drift, passing another offshoot labeled Wooch. Not every offshoot was labeled, only a few here and there. Farther on, they came to two more bearing signs, Bydgoszcz and Gdańsk. Then the drift ended at an unexcavated rock wall.
We'll need to explore each of those offshoots we just passed, Conrad said.
But Jonty had been thinking.
Maybe not.
He wasn't entirely sure that he was right, so he asked, Am I correct that Tarnów is in southern Poland, east of Kraków?
Conrad nodded.
That's right.
And Gdańsk is in the north, on the Baltic Sea. Tell me where Kielce, Radom, and Łódź are located.
They run south to north from Tarnów to Warsaw, Conrad said. I've been to all of them.
And I assume that Bydgoszcz is north of Warsaw, he asked.
It is. About 200 kilometers, Conrad said, as is Gdańsk.
The Soviets were, if nothing else, simple in their thinking. Why complicate matters when something easy could accomplish the same goal?
The towns tell us where to go, he said.
He turned and headed back to the offshoot marked Bydgoszcz.
This town is north of Warsaw. Which one is immediately south?
Łódź, Conrad said.
Jonty pointed.
Which is back there, about 30 meters.
What we're after is in between.
It had to be. He walked down the tunnel about 20 meters until he came to an unmarked offshoot. He motioned to Vic, who hustled ahead and stopped at the next offshoot.
Łódź? He asked his associate.
It is.
Jonty pointed.
This has to be Warsaw.
He did not wait for a reply, simply headed down the tunnel, which ended at a partial cave-in similar to the one he and Vic had seen last evening. A barrier, but passable. He squatted his stout frame down and squeezed under the ledge. The others followed. Their lights revealed another empty chamber, similar to the one Jonty saw at the end of the other offshoot. A dead end? Conrad, though, seemed intrigued, studying the far wall, his light tracing a path up and down.
What is it? Jonty asked.
Chapter 32 Cotton darted left, momentarily out of the line of sight for the doorway. Then he rushed toward the open portal, slamming its heavy paneled door shut and engaging the iron latch. That should stop Sonya's advance long enough for him to make his escape back the way he came. He noticed, though, that all the rooms on this level faced an inner courtyard, with a covered arcade wrapping the entire upper floor. A closed door to his left opened out to the loggia, as did two mullioned windows. It would not take Sonya long before she readjusted her path and came at him from that angle. At least his instincts had been right. Tchaikovsky had been playing Tom Bunch. The Poles knew he'd come. So, make it look good. He ran ahead, heading back through the assortment of rooms on the castle's north side, refinding the senator's hall, then the two exhibition halls and the wooden door that led into the adjacent building, the one whose lock he'd picked. He stopped and heard voices. A quick glance around one of the glassed exhibit cases and he spotted two security guards examining his handiwork at breaking the wire seal. No way he could escape there without some carnage. He decided to backtrack and find another way out, but he had to avoid Sonya. Hopefully all the doors leading from the inner loggia were locked, and her search for a way in would give him time to bypass her. He hustled through the north wing. Windows lined both sides of the rooms, all mullioned with watered glass, no way to see through. A blurry shadow moved past them on the outside, from room to room, stalking him from the exterior. Sonya. Had to be. At some point they were going to come face to face, probably at a far exit point where she'd come up to this floor. The same exit he would need to leave. Perhaps she knew he was trapped and was simply biding her time, waiting for him to figure things out. He was still toting the heavy wooden box, which made the going a bit awkward. He re-entered the Battle of Orsha room. His mind wound through the possibilities, and only one made sense. On his trip through the North Wing, he'd noticed that the rooms were all roped off, keeping visitors from getting too close to the furnishings. The rope used was sturdy nylon, threaded through iron pedestals. He headed back and retrieved three lengths, obtaining a good 100 feet. He heard glass shatter. Apparently, Sonya had grown impatient. He carried the rope and the box back to the small study that jutted off the Orsha room and locked the door from the inside, engaging an iron latch. He headed back outside onto the loggia, laid the wooden box down, and tied the rope to one of the stone pillars. He tossed the rest over the side and saw that there was enough slack to make it to the grass below. He quickly reeled the rope back up and tied the end to the box, then maneuvered it to the ground. He heard the door back in the study being forced. Sonya or the guards were trying to make their way in, but the iron latch was holding. He wrapped the rope into a loop and stepped into it. He heard muted gunfire. They appeared to be trying to shoot their way past the door. He recalled that its wood was not all that thick, more just an interior door for privacy, not security. Go. Now. He hopped over the rail and began his descent, releasing the coil around his waist in short bursts and keeping his feet planted to the castle's stone. He'd purposefully located the rope so he could use one of the buttresses as a path, avoiding the walls themselves as they were dotted with obstacles. He was also careful with the slack at the bottom, keeping plenty there so as to not jostle the wooden box. The descent was relatively easy, and he was nearing the grass when he looked up and saw Sonya and two guards staring down at him. Her gun came up into view, and she nestled the end of the barrel to the rope and fired. His support severed, he fell the remaining 20 feet, pounding onto the hard turf, which hurt his nearly 50-year-old body. He glanced back up and saw her aim the gun down toward him and fire, stitching the grass to his left with two rounds. He ignored the pain in his legs and snatched the box from the ground, lunging into an open arcade to his left, out of her line of fire. He had to leave the castle grounds, so he ditched the rope wrapped around him and freed the box, running ahead, down another covered arcade that led to a passage opening on the far side of the castle at the inner lawn, near where he'd first entered the administration building. No one was in sight. He assumed the guards themselves knew nothing about what was really happening. To them, this was real. So he had to avoid them. Exterior lights atop the buildings began to spring to life, dissolving the darkness and making him much more visible. He turned right and bolted back toward the main gate, passing the cathedral and the museum. Beyond the archway, he found the same brick-lined passage that led down to street level. Lights burned here and there, illuminating the path. At the end of the incline, he saw that the heavy wooden gates were now closed. They were also tall, as were the surrounding walls. No way to scale either, and no telling what type of lock secured the exit. He had to find another way out, and fast. He could not go back inside the castle grounds. The guards would be on the move. To his left, a rough cobbled path ran along the base of the castle's outer wall. Another smaller wall paralleled the outside, overlooking the river 100 feet below. This had surely once been a path from which men and artillery could be shifted around the outer walls without risk. He ran down the path, visualizing in his mind the map of the castle's grounds he'd seen earlier outside the administrative offices. There was another way down. A popular spot, too. The Dragon's Den. He knew the story. King Krak had lived in a castle atop Vavil Hill. A village lay below, beside the river, on fertile lands, and would have been rich and prosperous if not for a fierce, fire-breathing dragon that occupied a cavern below the castle. The dragon liked to roam the countryside, eating sheep, cattle, and people. It particularly delighted in the taste of virgin flesh, as what dragon didn't. The beast devoured virgin after virgin, until only the king's daughter was left. It was then that King Krak declared that the brave hero who could slay the dragon would receive half the kingdom and his daughter's hand in marriage. Knight after knight tried to kill the dragon, and all were devoured. Then a poor young cobbler's apprentice wanted to try his luck. A mere boy, no warrior, no armor or sword. But he had a brain. He took a dead sheep and stuffed it with sulfur, then sewed it back together and left it at the mouth of the cave. The dragon swallowed the stuffed animal whole and soon developed a dreadful bellyache. The suffering creature crept down to the river Viswa and began to drink. He drank so much water that he eventually burst into pieces. End of dragon. Earlier, back at the main gate, Cotton had noticed the three large bones hanging over the entrance, suspended on chains. For centuries, these were believed to be the remains of the dragon. In reality, they belonged to a mammoth, a rhinoceros, and a whale. But the cave under the castle was real, and ahead, through the darkness, he spotted the narrow turret at the top of a brick tower that held the spiral staircase. An iron gate barred access, but when he approached, he noticed that it was secured by a modern keyed lock. He glanced around and saw no one. He was now on the castle's far west side, facing the river, which was over the wall to his right and 100 feet down. He heard people below out walking the riverbank, enjoying the summer night. Lots of them. Just what he needed. He laid the wooden box down and picked the lock, quickly passing through the portal and relocking the gate behind him. He descended the iron rungs in a tight circle and finally found himself standing in a limestone cave. Nothing but blackness ahead. The attraction closed for the night. An electrical box was attached to one wall, and using his phone for light, he tripped the breakers. The rocks came alive with backglow, exposing the dragon's den in all its shadowy detail. He hustled through the first chamber and into the next, the walls narrowing and heightening, the ceiling 30 feet high. He heard a noise from above. Voices. Most likely the exterior security cameras had revealed his presence. He kept going and headed into another chamber, this one with a stone vault supported by a set of brick pillars and decorated by rock projections, chimneys, and fissures, the ambiance trying to evoke thoughts of the mythical dragon that supposedly once lived here. The 200-foot-long cave attracted hundreds of thousands of visitors each year, a place where superstition had evolved into folklore. He spotted the exit. A pointed arch portal with another iron gate blocking it. Beyond, on the street that faced the river, a sculpture of the dragon stood. People congregated around it. He approached the gate and saw another lock, which was easy to pick. He emerged at the foot of Vavil Hill, the castle towering high above. He dissolved into the crowd, box in hand. A host of stray constellations circled overhead. He recognized the tangled silver chain of the Pleiades. He kept walking. And resisted the urge to turn back and glance up at the outer walls, where Sonia Drago was surely watching. Mission accomplished. Chapter 33. Jaunty walked over to Conrad, who was still staring at the salt wall. "What is it?" he asked. "There's something odd here." He stared at the wall too, comprising individual blocks mortared together, rising from the floor up 5 meters to the ceiling.
"These were built by the miners to block off unused tunnels. It was a safety measure against fires."
He reached out and stroked the rough gray-green surface.
"They cut the blocks themselves," Conrad said. "The mortar is salt mixed with water. It makes a good cement. The thicker the mortar lines, the newer the wall. The oldest used little to no mortar, but they were strong. I know of walls that are still standing after 400 years. This one is different."
The others walked over.
"How so?" Eli asked. "The blocks are too perfect, and the mortar is thin."
Jaunty waited for more.
"The miners used anything and everything to build the walls. Trash, lumber, even horse manure. When they chipped the salt blocks into rough rectangles, no two were ever the same. They built fast, with little regard for craftsmanship. The idea was to get it up and done. So the mortar lines would be wavy, the layers all different. Nobody but them was ever going to see it, so it didn't matter what it looked like."
Jaunty began to notice what Conrad was saying. The individual rectangles here were all remarkably similar, many of the edges impeccably straight. The mortar joints varied in width, but still crisscrossed in a defined pattern. The mortar is thin, which would mean this is old. But the blocks are too perfect to be old.
Conrad nodded.
What are you saying? Eli asked.
Conrad drew closer to the wall.
Vic, could you go back out to the main tunnel and get some of the iron pieces we saw lying around?
Jonty caught his acolyte's attention and nodded yes.
Do it.
Vic left the chamber.
You think there's something on the other side?
Jonty asked Conrad.
I've seen it before where chambers were walled up. It's not unusual. But whoever did this wasn't in a hurry. They cut the blocks from the salt and made sure they were all close to the same. If we're assuming this is the Warsaw chamber you are looking for, then there could be more to it on the other side.
Vic returned with several pieces of rusted iron. Conrad grabbed one of the bars and started to work the thin mortar in one of the side joints, where the blocks met the main salt wall.
This isn't mortar. It's just part of the wall collapsed into the block. They definitely built this in front of an opening.
Conrad kept scratching the joint away, using the thin edge of the iron as a chisel. Salt dust sprayed away as a crease began to form. He then used the bar as a fulcrum and forced the iron farther into the seam, angling it away from the block, trying to pry it free. Then he stopped.
What?
Jonty asked.
It moved.
Was that a problem? Did it mean danger? Everything was illuminated by the motion of their headlights, but Conrad settled his beam down and used it to trace a path about 2 meters up the block wall. A meter-long crack had formed. Conrad used the iron to deepen it into a valley. Vic worked with another piece to clear away more mortar from the crack to the floor, revealing the crude outline of a doorway.
Can we get through? Eli asked.
We shall see, Conrad said.
Jonty watched as the doorway was finally cleared. Vic and Conrad had used the iron bars to strip away the mortar, then extract the blocks one by one. He'd cautioned them to be careful, because the blocks might need to be replaced. They left the last 2 rows at the bottom, as they could be stepped over. Beyond was a short tunnel that ended at a wooden door. They all approached. No lock, only a rope handle. The salt wall had apparently been deemed enough protection. Vic opened the door, which had been hung on wooden dowels. Beyond was another chamber. Racks of wooden shelves stood in 5 lines like a warehouse. None of the lumber was nailed. More dowels. The shelves were packed with black plastic bins, each container sealed at the top with heavy black tape.
Somebody has a sense of humor, Eli said. It's a pantry. That's what this is, tucked safely within walls of salt.
You see, Jonty, it is real.
That it was. He noticed the floor, a layer of crystallized salt wall to wall that had not been disturbed in a long time. He pointed it out.
That was done to help with moisture, Conrad said. The miners would crush the salt and spread it out on the floor to absorb humidity.
For someone who dealt in information, the value of a cache like this could be immeasurable. True, the vast majority was probably unimportant and meaningless, but somewhere amid all this information there was surely something of value. They stepped inside. He motioned, and Vic lowered one of the plastic containers to the floor, peeled away its tape, and snapped off the top to reveal stacks of paper, some bound together with string, most loose, hundreds of pages, all in excellent condition thanks to the climate in the mine, ideal for pulp preservation. He and Eli each grabbed a handful of the pages and examined them, most written in Polish, many in Russian. Polish he was okay with, but Russian was not part of his repertoire.
These are surveillance reports, Eli said, motioning with the stack he held. From the Svuzhba Bezpieczeństwa.
He saw that Eli was right. Some documents were statements from SB field agents and informants, most of them originals. Others were carbon copies of reports filed up the chain of command. Lots of names, dates, and places. Where people went, who they met with, what they said, what they saw and heard. If this one box was representative, there were tens of thousands of documents in this archive.
The possibilities could be endless, Eli said.
Or useless, he added. All of this is from a long time ago.
That's probably what someone else thought, too. And look what happened there.
He knew exactly who Eli was referring to. Tchaikovsky.
Good point.
Eli started to speak again, but Jonty cut him off with a wave of his hand.
Let's you and I walk back to the other side of the wall and speak in private.
He caught Vic's glance and indicated that he wanted Conrad occupied and kept out of hearing range. He and Eli left the chamber and retreated far enough away that they could speak in private.
Keep your voice down, he cautioned. Don't trust your guide.
Would you?
Of course not. I appreciate your precautions. But come now, Jonty. You and I both know the odds. Somewhere in all that old paper is information that people in positions of power and influence today would not want revealed. There's value here. I can feel it. Look at what happened with Lech Wałęsa. He had a past that he did not want revealed. He tried hard to deny and disclaim it, but it stuck to him like a rash. There could be others just like him, and those people may be willing to pay to keep their secrets.
From preparing for the auction, he knew that the SB had utilized tens of thousands of informants. What they reported had to be documented, since the Soviets loved to write everything down. Also, somebody went to a lot of trouble to conceal this cash, and that could not have been for nothing. And Eli had a point about both Tchaikovsky and Wałęsa. But going through all this would take time.
I've been thinking, Eli said, let's not offer this for sale tomorrow. Let's hold it and study what's here, finding the ones that are actively negotiable today. I know of at least one buyer who would pay to have it all intact.
He did too.
Poland. We either need to come back here ourselves, or hire people to do it for us, Eli said. Those containers have to be searched. That could take years, and this is not a public place. We'll do it slowly. No rush. It's not going anywhere. And you have access through your guide in there. I realize you don't trust him. But keep that relationship viable, and we can study this at our leisure.
Everything he was hearing made sense.
You're cutting me in on this cash.
Absolutely. We made a deal.
And this is too big for either of us. But together we can handle it. I also need your men to gain access. Sure, I could cultivate my own. But why start over when you already